The Glenn Show is brought to you by the Manhattan Institute. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber at glennlowry.substack.com. As a subscriber, you will receive new episodes on Mondays instead of Fridays and get access to exclusive content, ticket pre-sales to live events, monthly Q&As with Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter, and other benefits. Your contribution will also help to fund grassroots initiatives that empower Black development across the country as we donate 10% of our profits to the Woodson Center. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. You've tuned in to The Glenn Show. I'm Glenn Lowry, professor at Brown University, and John Paulson, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York City, which sponsors The Glenn Show. And I'm with Matthew Martins, who is a lawyer. He's a partner at WilmerHale, the big firm in Washington, D.C., co-chair of the Securities Litigation and Enforcement Practices Group, as I understand, and author of a book just published last year called Reforming Criminal Justice, A Christian Proposal. And we're here to discuss Matt's book. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me on, Glenn.
You're welcome. So I moved to ask, a Christian proposal, are you directing your recommendations to society as a whole or to the community of believers? Does it make a difference?
So I would certainly commend my proposal, my recommendations to society as a whole. I believe as a Christian that what Christianity teaches is good for society as a whole. But my most immediate audience is Christians, because I want to let the discussion start at home before I turn it to others. I want to convince my fellow believers that this is in fact just and something they should support. So it's certainly in the first instance to Christians, but as I said, I think it's good for everybody.
Now, in addition to being a lawyer, I understand you have a master's degree in biblical studies from the Dallas Theological Seminary.
I do.
I did read your book, and I'm not a theologian. In fact, I'm not a practicing Christian. I used to be kind of a lapsed. We don't have to go into that. It's not really relevant to the discussion at hand. But I'm wondering, what's the foundation of the view that you developed, the theological view about reform of criminal justice? And can you spell that out for us?
Yeah, so it's interesting that one of the most repeated phrases in the Christian scriptures is the command to love our neighbors as ourselves. It actually appears 8 times in the Christian scriptures in both the Old and the New Testaments. It's repeated or endorsed multiple times by Jesus Christ in the Gospels. It's repeated by the Apostle Paul in Romans, in Galatians. It's repeated by James, the brother of Jesus, in the book of James. But interestingly, the first appearance of it ever in the Christian scriptures is in Leviticus 19:18, in a paragraph that begins, "Do no injustice in court," but then ends with the command, "But instead, love your neighbor as yourself." In other words, the command to love our neighbors as ourselves was originally rooted in an obligation to do legal justice to our neighbors. And what I'm trying to do in the book is, through the scriptures and through the thoughts of Christian ethicists and theologians across the ages and across denominations, I'm trying not to be sectarian, is to spell out what it means to love our neighbors as ourselves in a legal context. And what I conclude is that most fundamentally what it means is to judge our neighbors' cases accurately, to judge them truly, meaning both rightly defining what is right and wrong, and then rightly determining who did right and wrong. And I think there's implications then of this principle of accuracy, namely that the means that we as fallible people achieve accuracy is through due process. And so as Christians, we should be committed to due process because of our belief about human fallibility, combined with our commitment to accuracy. And that even in a world where you offer due process, if the judge or the jury or the decision maker is not impartial, all the process in the world won't achieve accuracy. So we need not only due process, but we need impartiality to achieve accuracy. And then accuracy also entails not only rightly determining who committed right and wrong, but rightly speaking about how right or how wrong a particular wrong was. A murder is not a jaywalking. And so proportionality is part of how we're accurate. It speaks truth about the seriousness of the wrong. And then lastly, accountability for those who govern, for those who administer justice, that we speak truly, that we speak accurately when those tasked with committing justice commit injustice in the process. So that's how I understand the Christian teaching about loving our neighbor to play out in the context of a legal system.
Okay, love. Love is at the center of things here.
Absolutely.
Cornel West is a friend of mine, and he's fond of saying, social justice is what love looks like in public.
Yeah. MLK said, you know, justice is love ruling rightly, love ruling justly.
What does that mean in the context of dealing with lawbreakers and policing and victims of crime and so on? What does it mean to love the offender?
Well, for the Christian, what love means is to seek their best. To love someone is to seek their best. And what it looks like to seek the best of someone who's been a crime victim will look different than what it looks like to seek the best of someone who is the crime perpetrator or the criminally accused. But ultimately, the goal is to seek their best. And it's not in anyone's best interest to judge cases inaccurately. If you reach false convictions, which our country does at far too high a rate, I think, if we judge cases inaccurately, we've lied to the victims about justice being achieved on their behalf. We've lied to society and left them exposed to future wrongs by that wrongdoer. And we've not loved the wrongdoer, the actual wrongdoer, because that person's been denied what Christianity teaches is the corrective benefits of the law, the restraining effects on that person. And so, if we don't judge accurately, we're not loving anyone. But at the same time, even if we rightly determine right and wrong, seeking someone's best could include, you know, and often does include for a wrongdoer, punishing them, but not punishing because we want to hurt them. And I think this is the key to me, the key distinction between Christian justice and other justice, other forms of justice, other so-called justice, which is that we punish as Christians wrongdoers not because we want to hurt them. The goal is not to rebalance the pain scales of the universe. The goal is not, you hurt me, so I'm going to hurt you. You took my eye, so I'm going to make sure you go without an eye. The goal of Christian justice, meaning a justice premised on love, is that I want to correct you because I don't want you alienated from this community. We want you back. But what you're doing, the behavior you're engaging in, is alienating you from the community. And so loving you is letting you know that you're on a path that's self-destructive, but ultimately with a goal to bring you back.
Well, I'm just thinking in the position of somebody who's been victimized viciously, awfully victimized. A loved one has been killed. They've been maimed. They're angry. They want revenge. They want retribution. And we have a political system, don't we, that is inclined toward responding to that kind of, and indeed not only responding to it, but playing it up and playing to that kind of sentiment. So how does this imperative, this counterintuitive imperative of loving my enemy, loving my victimizer, play out as a practical matter in the political processes and, you know, that end up producing our punishment regime?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'd say that when someone's victimized by crime and they feel that desire, that anger, I understand that. I mean, I've sat with crime victims as a prosecutor for 9 years, and I understand the pain they feel. It's natural for us as humans to feel that. And I don't, what I'm encouraging, though, is the system to some degree stand as a buffer between that and to seek a different goal rather than act in the emotion of the situation. The emotion's understandable, but what I want is a system that says what we're trying to achieve is this person's good. Now, none of that's going to get likely sorted out entirely at the sentencing process. right? That's when the passions are running the highest, when the wrongdoer has not yet really begun to experience the punishment and hasn't been able to reach a point of what Christians would call repentance. And some people may never reach that point. But what I'm pushing back against, I guess, is the mentality of treating people, even people who do wrong, as disposable. So I'll just give an example that I use in the book, which is three strikes laws.
Yeah.
Listen, I get the frustration with people who continue to commit low-level, relatively low-grade crime repeatedly. But I don't believe that the right response to that, I don't believe the Christian response to that, is to treat people as disposable. You know, there's, I talk about in my book, there's a man in Mississippi today, as we're talking, a human being, who is in prison for 25 years for possession of an ounce and a half of marijuana.
Wow.
Probably possession of less marijuana than I smell walking to lunch every day outdoors in Washington, right?
Right.
And yes, had he committed some other crimes? Yes. Was he a career violent criminal? He was not. Should he be punished for the things he did? Sure. But to treat a man as disposable over an ounce and a half of marijuana is appalling to me. And it's appalling to me as a Christian, because I believe he's someone made in the image of God who's entitled to my love, even as a wrongdoer. He's entitled to me seeking his best. And I don't look at throwing a man in jail for 25 years over an ounce and a half of marijuana as seeking his best or, frankly, anybody else's best. It's an angry, frustrated, emotional outburst in response to what he did, an angry response by the system. And that's the type of thing I'm trying to push back against.
You say Alabama.
Mississippi.
Oh, Mississippi.
Yeah.
There's a pretty high rate of professing Christ as our Lord and Savior in that electorate, is there not?
So certainly. And I guess part of why I wrote my book is I want to write to, as I said at the beginning, fellow Christians who have been schooled in that way of thinking as being just, and push back against that. As I said, I'm trying to start at home, writing to fellow Christians and saying, I'm not sure how we got to this point where we view this human being, this man made in God's image this way, but we've gotten off track. And I want you to reconsider that. As a friend, I'm really trying to write as a friend to friends. I'm not an outsider to evangelical Christianity. I've been a conservative evangelical my entire life. My father was a minister, a Baptist minister for 36 years. I went to a conservative evangelical college. I went to a conservative evangelical seminary. I'm a member of a conservative evangelical church to this day, a relatively well-known one, Capitol Hill Baptist Church. I'm not an outsider. I'm not a critic throwing stones as an antagonist. I'm a friend writing to friends, asking them to reconsider the system they support.
Accuracy. You identified love in the practice of criminal justice with accuracy.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, I guess because I start with the notion that God is the God of the Bible, the Christian God, as revealed in the Bible, describes himself as a God of truth. Jesus Christ, in fact, said he's the way, the truth, and the life. And so, as people made in God's image, when we exercise his justice, when we exercise the power that he's delegated to us as humans, and any power we carry out is only delegated power in the Christian view, we should reflect what he's like. And he is a God who is loving, but who describes himself as truth. And so those aren't things in tension with one another. Part of being loving, as I argue, is being true. It's not the entirety of it, but part of being loving is being true, being accurate. And as I said, I think that involves both rightly describing, rightly identifying what is right and what is wrong, and then also rightly identifying whether this person committed that wrong.
I see. you start out reminding us that the criminal law authorizes the state to use force against citizens who are found to be in violation of it.
Yep.
And that's a really important fact about what law is in the argument of your book, is it not? Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's a degree to which when we think about the criminal justice system, we sanitize it in our mind. We sanitize what it is and thus minimize the moral gravity of what we're doing. In other words, when we look back on prior generations, early America, for example, where they used corporal punishment on people, we view ourselves as much more sophisticated and humane than them. They were the people who were brutal, and we view ourselves as much more urban, much more sophisticated, much more modern. And what I want people to understand is that there's no criminal justice system, and especially not ours, that operates on anything other than physically coercive force. That is how it operates. No one ends up in jail except through a threat or an application of force. So Justice Scalia wrote a famous Supreme Court decision called California versus Hadari D, in which he used that very definition of an arrest. It is a threatened or actual application of physical force. You either respond to the threat and submit, or you refuse to respond to the threat and the force is brought to bear. But again, the system in either instance is operating based on physically coercive force. No one ends up in a jail cell other than through a threat of force that will stuff you in, or your submission to that threat and walking in. No one is, I mean, you're kept in a jail cell by means of physical coercion in the forms of bars and cement walls. And if you doubt that, try to make a run for it and see what happens from the men in the towers, right? I mean, the threat is always there of physically coercive force. And I don't say any of that as a criticism, but as a description. I want people to not just watch Law and Order on TV and see this very organized and sophisticated courtroom scene where after the person's convicted, they're calmly handcuffed and walked to the back and think that this is not an extremely significant event from a moral perspective. That by when we are talking about using physically coercive force against another human being, we have to ask, what's our authority for doing that? What's my moral authority to use physically coercive force against you or other members of society? What's your moral authority to do that to me? What's my moral authority to elect people to do it on our behalf? And what are the constraints and restraints on me as someone doing that? I start with the general assumption from scripture that it is wrong to use physical force against other people. I think that's the baseline assumption. And you see that in many places, including when harming others by physical force is punished. The baseline assumption is that I don't have the right to use physical coercive force against other people. And so I need to answer the question, if that's what the justice system is, where do I get off using that against other humans? What's giving me, I know it gives me the power to do it. I mean, our U.S. Constitution and statutes and men and women with guns. But I'm trying to answer the question, what's the moral authority for me to do that? Because I think that's the question I have to ask as a Christian, is where do I get the moral authority to do that?
And what's the answer?
Well, all authority, to the extent it exists, comes from God. All power, the Christian scriptures teach, resides in God. All authority, Jesus says, on heaven and earth is given to him. And whatever authority I have is on loan. It's delegated. So you see this, for example, in a passage like Romans 13, where Paul says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities because there is no authority but from God. And in fact, he goes on to say that the people who are exercising authority as government officials, if they're doing it justly, are exercising authority literally as ministers of God. That's the word he uses, minister, sometimes translated deacons. You know, we hear of government officials in other countries referred to as ministers, you know, the minister of defense. We don't use that terminology, but it's Christian terminology, literally right out of Romans 13, where God says that the authority is delegated. And if you combine that with the Christian teaching that we're made in God's image, meaning we're people who are to reflect what God is like in all areas of our lives, if we're exercising delegated authority from God as ministers of God in the image of God, then we need to exercise that authority in God's way, according to his justice.
You know, I knew Richard John Newhouse when he was living. The late Father Newhouse was a friend of mine. And I noticed you cite him at a certain point on this question of whether religiously motivated views about public policy should be taken seriously, even by people who are not believers.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, Newhouse is a great example. I think I also cite Philip Gorski at Yale, who I think writes very compellingly on this in his book, American Covenant. I recently had a question about this at one of my speaking events from someone who I understood from the question didn't share my faith and sort of was like, isn't this dangerous, you know, in this world where people are talking about Christian nationalism?
Right.
And my response was this. I said, first of all, it's not practically possible. And Gorski's great on this, articulating this as someone who is not himself an evangelical, but I think he really understands the sociology of religion. It's not possible for me to enter the public square, and nor would it be honest for me to do so and act based on anything other than my religious convictions. In other words, when I'm trying to decide as a which candidate is more just, I necessarily think about justice through my religious lens. Now, I also think about justice, meaning that I don't use physically coercive force to impose all my views on other people. Part of my understanding of justice is not only what I believe is right and wrong, but also part of my justice definition is when I'm morally entitled to use physically coercive force to impose that view on you, sort of back to what I was talking about. That's right. Part of my definition of justice is when am I allowed to use the state to promote that view. So that's sort of part of my two parts of my answer. One, it wouldn't be possible for me to go into the public square and think about policy issues other than through the lens of my faith. My faith teaches that there's no aspect of my life in which I get to not be a Christian. And as I said, secondly, though, my faith also informs when I should and when I shouldn't use the state to promote those views. And what I said recently to this person who asked me this question at an event, I said, the beauty of America is not that I'm asked to set aside my religious views and you're asked to set aside your deeply held convictions when we go to the voting booth. The beauty of America is that we settle these disputes in a voting booth rather than on a battlefield. We settle these disputes by ballots, not bullets. I try to persuade you to my view. You try to persuade me to your view. Your views and others' views may be based in religion, maybe my faith, maybe a different faith, maybe a different understanding of my faith, maybe entirely secular premises. I don't fault you. I don't hold it against you, whatever the source of your deeply held views is. I just want to debate you. And then we want to vote. And I accept the results for the next 2 years, and then we do it again. To me, that's the beauty of America, is that we solve our disputes that way, rather than how, for most of history, disputes, including over religiously held values, were settled, which was shooting at each other. And so I don't think it's practical, and Gorski, I think, is compelling on this. It's not practical to expect believers, whether religiously motivated believers or otherwise motivated believers, to think that we're going to set aside our deeply held views and cast ballots with those out of our mind. That's not going to happen. So it's the opportunity to persuade and then the opportunity to vote that is what is the beauty of our country.
Okay, so we've been talking about the appropriateness of a religiously informed critique of criminal justice, and you've amply ably, I should say, defended the position. But what about the content of that religiously grounded view? You say loving thy neighbor, the offender, as well as the victim, the suspect, as well as the victim are my neighbors. Loving means for the accused an accurate adjudication of the charges against him or her. And this accuracy is vouchsafed by due process, which depends on impartiality and accountability and so on. So can you talk a little bit about the playing out of the accuracy mandate in terms of due process and why due process depends critically on accountability, impartiality, and so on?
Yeah. So if you think about it, when I'm called upon, let's say I'm a juror, called as a juror in a case, or you're called as a juror, we're being asked to decide what happened in the past at a time when we weren't present. So I'm not clairvoyant. I don't have a time machine. I don't read minds. And so when I'm called upon to make that decision, the only way I can do that is through a process that surfaces and tests the relevant evidence. I need that process to surface the evidence. I need it to bring that evidence to me, make sure all of the relevant evidence is brought to my attention. And then I need a process that tests the evidence, because something that could look like good evidence at first might turn out, with a little poking and prodding, to not be that reliable. So I need a process that does that. You know, in the American system, that process is a jury trial in an adversarial system where each side can call witnesses, introduce documents, present exhibits, and the other side can either question those witnesses or offer alternative exhibits or alternative documents. And we do that with in front of a group of people who are impartial, hopefully, meaning they don't have a dog in this fight. They aren't somebody who's got an axe to grind as an ideological matter. We try to test for that through questioning. They're not somebody who's got a personal connection to the matter. We try to sort that out at the beginning. We want the people who are deciding to be people who can be neutral, who can be fair and say, in fact, they take an oath. I'm here to decide the case on the facts and the law. I always argue that to jurors in closing. I said, in America, we don't have professionals who decide cases. We think when the important thing needs to get done, to quote Chesterton, we take 12 average people off the street. When something really important needs to be decided, we go to average people. We believe that's where the wisdom is, in a group of people who aren't committed. Chesterton's great on this. He says the problem with professionals deciding these cases is not that they're necessarily malicious, but that over time they just start to see the same guy in the same place, the usual man in the usual place, as he puts it. They can become cynical. The great thing with jurors is, you know, you might do this once every few years, but it's not like day in and day out, hour after hour, you see another guy standing there, right? So we want somebody who's impartial, who can be detached, who can look at the evidence that's been surfaced and tested, and then reach a verdict, hopefully a fair verdict, hopefully a true verdict, an accurate verdict. But we also recognize that the system is run by fallible people. Christians say fallen people. Madison writes about this in Federalist 51, where he says, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. Yeah. And if government were run by angels, then we'd have an entirely different situation too. But the challenge, he says, is that in a government administered by men over men, we need the government to restrain the governed, and we need the government to restrain itself. I think so. I mean, he doesn't state it in Christian terms, but that's a very Christian concept, that the government's run by fallible people. And so those fallible people will do unjust things. So there's been 3,433 exonerations since the advent of forensic DNA technology in August of 1989. They're all recorded on the National Register of Exonerations, maintained by the University of Michigan Law School. And you can sort them, including by cases of government misconduct. police or prosecutorial misconduct. And if you click the button that says official misconduct, it sorts out 60% of those 3,433 exonerations were the result of misconduct. 60%. And so what I argue is that Christianity...
Excuse me, Matt. What is misconduct in this context?
So it could be a variety of things. Most frequently, it is hiding evidence of the defendant's innocence rather than handing it over to the defense. That's the most frequent type of misconduct, what the law calls a Brady violation based on a Supreme Court case called Brady versus Maryland. So we see these acts of misconduct, and Christianity has an answer to that, which is that part of being accurate means speaking accurately about the wrongs of the governed, exactly what Madison was getting at. How do we restrain the government? Well, part of it is that we punish the governed, the governing, the governors, even when they're wrong. We don't just punish the governed. We don't believe in a world in which the government is not accountable, at least in theory. Irenaeus of Lyon writes about this in the second century. He's a bishop, Christian bishop, and he writes in his book Against Heresies. He said, when the magistrate acts to the subversion of justice, then he too must perish. So this idea of the governors themselves being subject to accountability in their administration of justice is a central implication of accuracy. So that's, you know, that's how I think those pieces fit together there, that we hold the government accountable to doing justice and punish the government actors when they don't. In theory, that's what we should do.
Let's talk about life insurance. I hate to think about the fact that I may not live forever, but it is a fact. And in my case, in my 70s, I have to think about what would happen if I weren't here and the people who depend upon me no longer had me around for their support. As a part of a sensible financial plan for myself, I have to consider the role of life insurance, and it's important. In my case, I'm about to retire from my job at Brown University. Part of my benefit package there includes a term insurance policy, which I will need to replace. I'm going to be in the market for insurance, and I'm going to use Policy Genius to help me make the right choice. Getting life insurance today means that I will have peace of mind so that if something were to happen to me, my family can cover expenses while getting back on their feet. The same is true of you. Luckily, Policy Genius can help you compare your options from top companies, and their team of licensed experts is on hand to help talk you through it. Are you a parent or a caregiver? Life insurance could help you take care of your loved ones in the event that the unthinkable were to happen. Policy Genius's technology makes it easy to compare life insurance quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, it may not offer enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. The time to act is now. Insurance rates will only go up as you age. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius has licensed award-winning agents who can help you find the best fit for your needs. They work for you, not the insurance companies. That means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance. No wonder they have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. So save time and money and provide for your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com. or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you can save. That's policygenius.com. Well, I was about to say, you're calling for reform. So I gather, and I know from reading your book, that we're a long way from actually realizing this ideal. Can you talk about that for a little bit? I mean, what's wrong with the way we're doing criminal justice now?
Yeah. Well, your listeners may have heard of something called qualified immunity. So this often comes up in the context of police officers who maybe engage in an improper shooting of a suspect or something, right? So the police have qualified immunity. And I'll just say, if you think qualified immunity is bad, I got more bad news for you. Prosecutors have absolute immunity. In a case called Imbler versus Packman back in, I think it was the late 50s, the Supreme Court said that prosecutors are absolutely immune, meaning cannot be prosecuted for any violation of your civil rights committed in their role as prosecutors, even intentional violations. So to put a finer point on that, if a prosecutor intentionally suppresses evidence of your innocence, the prosecutor cannot be sued in a federal civil rights lawsuit. Absolute immunity, even if it's intentional.
That's an act of Congress?
So it's a really interesting question. So the Section 1983, the federal civil rights statute, was passed as part of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1877, I think it was, right toward the end of Reconstruction, right? And so Section 1983 gives you the right to sue federal, state, and local government officials who violate your civil rights. And the Supreme Court read into that statute. It's nowhere in the text. The Supreme Court read into that this immunity doctrine. And they did it with two justifications, maybe three. One, they were like, kind of like, who would take these jobs if you could get sued? I'm kind of like, I don't know, maybe people who would acknowledge and protect your civil rights. I mean, maybe those people. Right. Then they said, number two, don't worry, a prosecutor that intentionally suppresses evidence of your innocence could be criminally prosecuted. And honestly, I can't believe adults wrote that on a piece of paper because in the more than near now coming up on 60 plus years since Imbler versus Packman, there's only one person ever, one prosecutor ever has gone to jail for hiding evidence of innocence in a criminal case. One. And he this occurred in Texas. This prosecutor convicted a man named Michael Morton, who wrote a book about his experience that I read recently. The prosecutor in that case sent him to jail by hiding evidence, sent him to jail for 25 years for a murder he did not commit. And when it was finally determined through DNA evidence that he had not committed this murder, the prosecutor was prosecuted and he got 5 days in jail. And that is the longest jail sentence that any prosecutor has ever gotten. So the Supreme Court said, don't worry about being able to bring civil rights lawsuits because prosecutors can be prosecuted for violating your civil rights. And I'm like, come on, like, are you seriously that gullible? You seriously wrote that down in a court opinion? Their last justification was, well, okay, but they could be subject to bar complaints because it's a violation of the bar rules that govern lawyers. So lawyers administering a system of self-regulation, they're like, those folks will make sure that they ride herd on prosecutors who violate your civil rights. And again, studies have been done cataloging the number of instances in which that's happened. Almost never. And to the extent it is, it's usually, the punishment is usually something like a censure. You know, that was bad. Don't do that again.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a minute.
Sure.
So the qualified immunity for prosecutors or absolute immunity for prosecutors means they can't be sued in as a civil matter.
Yeah.
You say there are over 3,000 exonerations that have been identified, 60% of which, if I heard you right, involve some kind of misconduct.
Yeah.
That would be quite a few civil lawsuits if they were allowed to be brought, would it not? And has the court any interest in discouraging the trial lawyer bar, no offense intended, from having a field day going around suing prosecutors for misconduct, to be sure, but is there not another side to the argument is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, so I guess I have a couple of responses to that. One, we're then designing a system in which there are essentially no ramifications for this, right? They're, as I said, they're not going to be prosecuted. There's really no material number of bar complaints that are ever sustained. And now we've eliminated the last alternative. So we've created a class of people that is entirely immune from wrongdoing and said, you're in charge of everybody else. Unrestrained power of that sort, I think, is extremely dangerous. So that's my first response. The second is this. To the extent what you're saying is that prosecutors are concerned that the system won't rightly sort out whether they actually engaged in misconduct, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for people who are sending other people to jail in that system saying, I don't trust that same system to make decisions even about financial liability, right? If you've trusted this system enough to stake somebody else's life on it, I don't see why you're so unwilling to let that same system judge your conduct. And that doesn't mean that I'm oblivious to the fact that I'm not oblivious to the fact that every defendant who's prosecuted is upset. You know, when I was a prosecutor, people didn't love it that I put him in jail either. And it doesn't mean that judges shouldn't scrutinize those cases in some way at the outset to try to sort out those cases that seem to have some merit that's worth looking into, as opposed to those who are frivolous on their face. But to create a world in which there's no circumstance in which you can bring the case, no matter how meritorious, no matter how intentional the wrongdoing, you're entirely blocked from the courthouse door, I think is unjust.
I move to ask you what you make of the summer of 2020, of George Floyd and the aftermath of people in the streets, complaints about police misconduct, structural racism and all that.
Yeah.
I gather you were still writing the book when those events went down.
Well, so I started writing afterwards. Mainly the reason I started writing afterwards, because I was looking at the debates in our country, the debates among friends of mine, the debates among fellow church members of mine. And I thought maybe I could help in some way to try to frame the discussion, to create a framework to talk about the issues. You know, when you say the events of 2020, there's a lot packed in there. I'll start with the riots in the street. It is unacceptable. You know, that's destroying other people's property, burning police stations to the ground. You know, outrageous. In particular way, to some degree, some cities and law enforcement, some cities sort of stood back and didn't stop it, whether that's in Portland or Minneapolis.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also know that it's a hotly disputed question. I've listened to your podcast with John McWhorter about the original verdict in the Derek Chauvin case, then the Fall of Minneapolis documentary. Yeah. Then you all talking about the fall of Minneapolis, then the Radley Balco response to the documentary.
And it ain't over yet.
I think he's only like one part into it. So, I guess I look at it like this. I didn't sit as a juror in the case, and I have not scrutinized the medical evidence and otherwise. I think you commented on this, like maybe that's not my expertise. I certainly didn't sit through the trial. I can say the jury reached a verdict that it was murder. I know what I watched on videos, and it was disturbing. And a jury reached a verdict that was a murder, and a lot of people disagree with that.
I wasn't so much asking for you to render an opinion on the trial of Derek Chauvin as much as to wonder whether that's not chickens coming home to roost about a system that's been in need of reform for a long time. And if it doesn't constitute, that is, the distrust in the system reflected in the way in which people reacted to not only George Floyd, but other such incidences, doesn't tell us something about what price we'll pay as a society. We don't reform criminal justice along the lines that you and others are advocating.
I think that's exactly right, which is that I think what it reflects is, regardless of the merits of Chauvin, I think I agree with what you're suggesting, which is that the response, regardless of whether it was justified, reflects pent-up frustration with a system that people feel operates in an unjust way, I think in particular, unjust way against the poor, that the real bias in the system is against the poor. And I think you've noted we should ask ourselves why that necessarily then falls on people of color. You know, I was listening to your discussion previously with John, I guess a week or two ago, about substantive color blindness versus procedural color blindness. I really liked that. You know, that you can say we adjudicated a particular case correctly, but that doesn't mean we should be colorblind to the way the system falls on particular groups in our society and ask ourselves what type of society have we structured that's yielding those outcomes. And I mean, that very much resonated with me. I think that's a question we do need to wrestle with as a country.
You have a whole chapter on history.
Yeah.
And when I looked at it, I wasn't sure it was going to be what I found, which was a recounting of contract labor and things of this kind, of the South using the criminal justice system as a way of reversing the outcome of the Civil War and keeping Blacks in a kind of proto-slavery condition and whatnot. What's the relevance of that history to 2024 streets of New York City or Chicago or whatever? How do you see that connecting to what we were just talking about?
Two things, at least two things. The first, that history should be a cautionary tale about how the system can be misused to nefarious ends, how a system that should be designed for the good of the people can be and has been used for evil, for injustice, that the justice system can be abused. I think that cautionary tale that I recount in that chapter about the justice system from the founding era up through the 1960s at least, but particularly after the Civil War, the way in which the criminal justice system was the mechanism to reverse the effects of the war. Right? People say the North won the war and the South won the peace. And the way the South won the peace was through the misuse of the criminal justice system by over-prosecuting Blacks and under-prosecuting whites. Over-prosecuting Blacks to perpetuate convict leasing and felon disenfranchisement, and under-prosecuting whites who were engaged in acts of terror against African Americans to oppress them after the war, to maintain the social structure that had been in place. And so understanding that abuse of the system, I think, is an important cautionary tale, that we should not be blindly trusting this a system with that much power. That's number one. Number two, we think today of Martin Luther King as an American hero, rightly so. But in April of 1968, when he was assassinated, he was a villain to most people.
To a lot of people.
Right? I mean, 20% approval ratings. It's almost unfathomable to us today, right?
I didn't know they were that low.
Yeah. I mean, we can't even get ourselves back and, you know, envision that. So he's assassinated on April 4th, 1968. That summer, a major party presidential candidate runs a campaign opposing the civil rights movement. Right? Again, hard to get our heads around. I mean, he called it the Southern Strategy. He called it law and order, right? But he's running against the civil rights movement.
And he won the election.
And he won the election. And he was in his first term in office the year I was born. And so what I want to say is, you may think everything has changed for the better and that the system that I recount in that history is long ago. And I want to say, if it's changed and everything's cleaned up, it's incurred entirely in my lifetime. Are you so sure that everything has been repaired in my lifetime? Because that was the state of affairs the year I was born. So that's why I think that history is important. It's a cautionary tale, and I want to make clear that it's not so long ago. And the time that's been available to clean it up isn't that long because I'm not that old.
There's so much to talk about in the book. One thing that struck me, you mentioned the fact that employment discrimination is a civil but not a criminal violation. And yet, by your logic about the use of the state's coercive powers to punish morally inappropriate action, it ought to be a criminal offense. You say you're not surprised to see that it's not. So what's your explanation for why employment discrimination isn't punished with the criminal law?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm getting at in that chapter is that when people decide what actions they're going to commit, we decide whether those things are crimes, right? We decide whether we're going to put a label of crime on certain wrongs and not on others. When someone speeds in my home state of Virginia more than 25 miles an hour over the speed limit, we call that a crime. When someone fires someone for their job or denies them a job because of their race, we call that not a crime. You want to know which one's, in my view, more morally inappropriate? It's not even close, right? The race discrimination. But we've made the judgment that the less morally serious act gets the least severe treatment by the law. And so I just want people to recognize that there's all types of moral judgments baked into the law, some of them good and some of them not so good. And this just goes back to what I said before about accuracy, that when I talk about accuracy, about truth in the justice system, I have to ask both whether the law has rightly defined right and wrong. And then I have to ask, have we rightly identified the person who committed that wrong? And then I have to ask, have we punished that wrong in proportion to how severe that wrong is? And I think that's just a simple example contrasting speeding with race-based employment decisions shows that judgments are being made by those passing the laws that don't necessarily align with the moral seriousness of the conduct.
I see. You also talk about 500,000 people on any given day being held in a jail somewhere awaiting trial when they haven't been convicted of anything. And you and I wouldn't be sitting there because we could bail ourselves out, but the guy doesn't have any bucks, ends up losing his job, losing his apartment. She might lose her children while they're sitting waiting for what's supposed to be a speedy trial, but can take a long time to come about.
Yeah,
where you're supposed to have adequate representation, but you might not have if you're one of these indigent defendants.
Yeah,
I guess that's part of the criminal justice system that needs reforming, in your view.
I mean, certainly. So there's a great article that's coming out in the Harvard Law Review by a professor at Columbia Law School, a man named Kellen Funk. Professor Funk is a graduate of Yale Law School. He has a PhD in American history from Princeton, and he writes about historical issues around American legal history issues around the American founding. And his article coming out in Harvard Law Review is called Bail at the Founding. And what he argues is, after reviewing all the historical evidence, he says there is no American tradition for cash bail, that the founding era was extremely protective of pretrial release, so much so that if after you were arrested, you couldn't be brought to jail until you were brought to the magistrate first to determine whether you got bail. They had to track the magistrate down at home, at work, in a bar, and he had to make a bail determination before you could be brought to jail. The American tradition is we don't punish people until after we determine their guilt. But in 1987, the Supreme Court flipped that, and they said for the first time, 211 years after the Declaration of Independence, the Supreme Court said, you can be denied bail, not just because we're worried about whether you're going to show up for trial. You can be denied bail because we think you might do something dangerous in the future. We haven't even proven you did anything dangerous in the past, but we're going to detain you because we think you might do something dangerous in the future. But the court said, but don't worry, this is a really narrow exception. The presumption is still liberty in the United States. But in the 37 years since that decision in 1987, we've gotten to a place where 500,000 people right this minute are detained in the United States prior to being convicted of anything. And the most offensive part of that is 75% of them are there for traffic offenses, property crimes, and drug possession. So somehow we went from you couldn't even be brought to jail for murder until we tracked the magistrate down at the tavern to we're going to lock you up on a traffic offense before you go to trial. And that whole denial of bail is not only contrary to the American tradition. So if someone's a conservative out here and you're against providing more generous bail, I just want to say you're not a conservative. You're conserving something, but it's not the American tradition that you're conserving, because the American tradition is pretrial release. But that process of denying people bail is used as a means to leverage guilty pleas out of people, because we make you serve your sentence before we decide your guilt. And we provide too few public defenders for people who are poor. You could wait 3 months, 6 months before you get even see your public defender. You're going to wait years before you get your trial. And that's what study after study shows. Or the public defender, when he finally shows up after 6 months, can say, hey, you can be released today on time served if you admit you did it. Or you can wait another few years for your trial. Your call. And that system undermines everything we try to achieve in our Constitution, which is ensuring people a right to an impartial trial in front of a jury, bail in advance so that they're free while they're waiting for trial. I mean, the system we've developed is entirely contrary to the American tradition.
Let me just ask as a point of information, what proportion of the cases resolved with a guilty plea the defendant goes with time served?
So I don't know the answer to that. That's going to happen more often in the less serious offenses.
Yeah.
But I'll say this. I mean, I just was dealing with a situation recently where I was assisting a friend with an issue, and there was a case involving someone who was charged with rape and pled out to a misdemeanor fourth degree assault. So the very serious crime, person gets very lenient plea agreement. So we're as citizens left here wondering, did he do it?
Yeah.
I mean, did he commit a rape? Because if he did, I don't want him getting a plea to fourth degree assault. How does that protect society? How does that tell the truth to the victim that we see what was done to you and we see that as a serious wrong against you? How does that do any good for the person who committed that crime? How is it for their best that they receive some slap on the wrist misdemeanor after committing a serious rape? I mean, this is a system, this plea bargaining system we have is a system that does not take crime seriously and speak the truth about it. It treats justice as up for negotiation. It treats it like a conveyor belt. And I'm concerned about that for crime victims. I'm concerned about that for our society at large. I'm concerned about that for the criminally accused.
Have you thought about the logistics of having all those cases come to trial?
So it's interesting. I have a friend, Clark Neely, at the Cato Institute, and he and I are like a two-man band on this topic. It's like this plea bargaining system is something we're really spun up about. He has a great idea. So about 95% of cases are resolved through plea bargaining.
Yeah.
And so one out of 20. So people say, well, you'd need 20 times as many judges and prosecutors if you were going to, you know, take all this stuff to trial. And there's a couple of responses to that. Well, one, we'd have to decide what we're actually going to treat as criminal and what we're not, and prioritize. Number two, you don't necessarily have to try all 20 in order to have some check in the system. So what Clark proposes, for example, is to say, some random number, some random sample of those plea bargains, the judge pulls it out and says, we're going to try this one. If the defendant's convicted, he gets the same sentence as he was offered in the plea bargain. But if he is acquitted, there's ramifications for the prosecution. And you can discuss what those are, but some type of
incentives. Now the prosecutor's got some skin in the game.
Exactly. That's exactly his. He's like, listen, if you trust your judgment enough to put somebody else's life on the line, Are you willing to put any skin in the game here? Because again, you got absolute immunity. I want to put some skin in the game to make sure that you aren't actually coercing people into pleading guilty who are innocent. And that doesn't mean we have to try all 100% of the cases. We could try some sample. And it would give us a sense of, it would create accountability. It would also give us some sense of how many of these pleas are actually of people who are guilty.
Okay, but I got to do this devil's advocate thing again. A lot of these people actually are guilty. And they reoffend when they're out awaiting trial for their previous offense. Now, I'm a politician or a public official responsible to the electorate, including those victimized by reoffending felons who have not been detained prior to their trial. Going from where we are now to a system where there was no pretrial detention, there'd be a lot of cases of people victimized by people who are awaiting trial. How do you manage the blowback from that?
So a couple things. One, part of the reason there's time for reoffending to occur is because of the extraordinarily long delay between someone being charged with a crime and someone being actually brought to trial. So again, I go back to the Constitution. The Constitution guarantees in the Sixth Amendment a speedy trial. The Supreme Court has ruled 8-year delay, that's a speedy trial. Years.
I had no idea.
Eight years. I recount in the book, this is not just a Southern phenomenon. I recount cases from Texas, Mississippi, California, Massachusetts, New York. Over and over, states bless the state courts reading the speedy trial guarantee have held that multi-year delays in bringing a case to trial satisfies the speedy trial guarantee. That's ridiculous. There's no way that's what speedy means. And it's certainly, again, not consistent with our constitutional tradition as a country where people were brought to trial within days, weeks, at most months after the event. So part of solving this problem is actually recognizing a speedy trial. I mean, just think about it. How is the victim served by trying a murder case 8 years after the fact? How does anybody remember what happened? How credible are witnesses going to be? Witnesses may have died. Evidence can be lost. I mean, the system is only designed to malfunction when you're trying events 8 years after the fact. I mean, seriously, if I started questioning you today about an event in 2016, like one afternoon, Glenn, what did you do? Like, I mean, you're going to be like, I don't know. It was 8 years ago. I might make it up or I might give you my best guess, but yeah, it's kind of a guess. It's a ballpark. So this delay is both undermining accuracy in the verdicts we do get. It's also, as you point out, allowing people to commit crimes in the meantime, that delay. My concern is also that the plea bargaining process itself allows offenders, serious offenders, to get back out on the streets much more quickly than they should. So take that rape case I mentioned a little while ago. This guy pleads to fourth degree assault. He's not going to be in jail or he's not going to be in jail very long. But if he really committed a rape, this is a real threat to society for him to be back out. And so our system is both under-punishing people through plea bargains that tell lies about the seriousness of what people did. And our system is allowing for long delays in getting to trial, which both allow the government to coerce people into guilty pleas and undermine the search for accuracy and allow people to reoffend in the meantime. I don't know how any of this is a system we should want, regardless of what side of the political divide you're on. We should want quick, accurate, reliable verdicts with punishment that fits the crime, that tells the truth about what happened.
Okay. Capital punishment.
Yeah.
So how does your theological foundation and your practical experience incline you to evaluate the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the constitutionality of the death penalty? And I especially am interested in hearing your thoughts on the racial disproportionality of the application of the death penalty, the evidence about that in the law.
Yeah. So here's what I say, and I say this as a Christian. I oppose the death penalty as currently practiced in the United States. All of those words are important. I oppose the death penalty as a Christian, as currently practiced in the United States. So let me try to break that down. I don't oppose the death penalty as a concept. I believe that Scripture, back to my point about delegated authority, I believe Scripture does reflect that God has delegated to mankind, humankind, the authority to impose the death penalty under certain conditions. And it's that last part that I think too many Christians leave out, under certain conditions. It's not carte blanche to administer for whatever crime we want, against whoever we want, however we want. And two things in particular, two of the elements of justice that I discussed before, of Christian justice, concern me about the death penalty. One is accuracy, and two is impartiality. So since the death penalty was reinstated, the modern death penalty in 1973, after the Supreme Court had found it unconstitutional and subsequently found it constitutional under revised statutes, just short of 9,000 people have been sentenced to death in the United States. 196 were later exonerated, meaning we condemned men and women to death for crimes that we now know they didn't commit. 2.2%. I always ask people, people are like, that sounds pretty good. I'm like, would you get on a plane that landed 98% of the time? Right? I mean, if right. I was in Washington National Airport flying up to Providence, Rhode Island to see you, and they came up on the public address system and said, we're boarding now, you know, flight such and such. Good news, it lands 98% of the time in Providence. I'd be like, you know, Glenn, we're going to have to do this by video. I'm not getting on that plane 98% of the time. And yet the reality is we're willing to board our fellow citizens, our neighbors, onto those planes, onto a system that crashes with that degree of with that degree of inaccuracy. And so I'm concerned about the accuracy of the system. Frankly, the inaccuracy in those cases that we devote the most resources to getting it right, makes me particularly concerned about the rate at which we're getting it wrong in cases where we devote a lot less resources to getting it right. So number one, I'm concerned about accuracy. Number two, I'm concerned about impartiality. What study after study shows is that the race of the victim is determinative in the administration of the death penalty in the United States. Interestingly, it's the race of the victim that is the most determinative. So just a couple of data points on that. The most comprehensive study on that was a study done by Iowa law professor David Baldus. It looked at a stratified sample of over 1,000 death penalty cases in Georgia. It controlled, it coded those for over 200 variables and then ran a regression analysis to try to isolate the effect of race. And what Baldus concluded is the only explanation they could ever find that explained the outcomes was race, the race of the victim. An anecdote in that respect is in September of 1991, Donald Pee Wee Gaskins was executed by the state of South Carolina. He was a serial killer, and his execution in September of 1991 drew national attention, but not because he was a serial killer, but because Donald Gaskins was the first white person in 47 years executed for killing a black person. It had been since 1944, 1,700 executions in the meantime. Not a single instance of a white person executed for killing a black person until Donald Gaskins. And that's what the Baldus study showed, is that you were more likely to get the death penalty if your victim was white than if your victim was black. And so I say, as a Christian, a system that has an accuracy problem, a system that punishes people by making race-based judgments about the value of lives, is not a system that I support. I accept the morality of the death penalty as a concept, but the conditions under which God delegated to us the authority to carry that out, meaning that we do it accurately and impartially, are not being met. And I oppose that as a Christian.
And you conclude the book with a chapter, as I recall, called What You Can Do.
That's it.
So maybe we could conclude this conversation with you sharing with our audience what you think we can do.
I didn't want to leave people who read the book without hope. It's easy to point out the problems. You can throw up your hands and feel anger and helplessness. And what I say to folks is there's things that the good news, to the extent there's good news in the middle of this mess, is that there's things we can do. First, I want us to just think about these issues differently. Think about them, to the extent I'm writing to Christians, think about them through what scripture tells us, what Christian ethical teaching tells us about what justice is. Think about them through the lens of the facts, how the system actually operates, not what you how you think it operates based on watching A Few Good Men or Law and Order. I want us to think differently. I want us to think differently theologically. I want us to think differently factually about the system. Secondly, I want us to talk differently about it. I want parents to talk to their kids about it. Citizens to talk to their neighbors about it, share with others. I mean, part of the reason I wrote the book, I dedicated the book to my kids because I want my kids to know what their dad thinks about this. I want them to be just people. And so I want people to speak differently about this issue. I don't want a world in which people joke about prison rape. It's no joking matter. Right. Rape's an evil, whether it's committed in a back alley, a dorm room, or a jail cell. And I want us to talk differently about that in a way that unfortunately we don't. And then I want people to vote differently. One of the, as I mentioned before, ballots, we have ballots instead of bullets to settle our disputes. You know, you can, what's great about the criminal justice system, it's one of the few areas where you can vote as a single issue voter. I don't care what my DA thinks about Ukraine funding. I don't need to worry about what my DA thinks about highway transportation bills, right? I need to know what the DA thinks about criminal justice. That's all I'm here to vote on. And so it provides a unique opportunity to be a single issue voter. And what we have seen in the last few years is that a motivated group of citizens can turn a DA out of office. And what I'm encouraging Christians to do is to get involved and vote for people who reflect Christian justice. When it comes to criminal justice. But even more important than that, you can be a juror. You get to vote as a juror. And again, what's amazing is the Declaration of Independence identifies the denial of the right to a jury trial as one of the grievances against King George that drove us to the Revolutionary War. And yet the most common question I get today is, how do I get out of jury service? And I always want to tell people, you're giving up a right that the people died for. And you have a chance to go do justice. If you turn down this opportunity, someone else is going to do it. And their justice may not be what you understand justice to be. I mean, view it as a stewardship, as an opportunity to participate in the system and to do justice. I talked before about those exonerations, those 3,433 men and women who were wrongly convicted. If you take out the quarter of them who were guilty pleas, and you take the three quarters who were convicted wrongly at trial, one person conscientiously performing their jury service could have stopped that. Because in our country, jury verdicts have to be unanimous in criminal cases. One conscientious juror who said, I'm going to demand accuracy, I'm going to hear this person out impartially, and I'm going to do my best to get it right, even at my own convenience, could have stopped those. And so I encourage us to view that as an amazing opportunity that's been available to few people in the history of the world. And even today, it's exceedingly rare. And I encourage people to participate in that jury process, to not try to get out of jury service, but to accept it as a stewardship and go do it justly.
That's powerfully said. Thank you very much, Matt. My guest has been Matthew Martins. He's the author of the book, Reforming Criminal Justice, A Christian Proposal. And I assure you, it's worth your while, Christian or not, if you're interested in criminal justice, to acquaint yourself with this fine book. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Glenn.
You're welcome.